I'm Tom Hall. This is Midday. In Baltimore City, many elementary school students and ninth graders have headed back to the classroom, and in 2 weeks, all K-12 students in the city will have the option of returning to in-person learning. My first guest today is Dr. Kalila Harris. She leads the K-12 policy team at the Center for American Progress. She says that the $126 billion in funding for education, including in the American Rescue Plan, creates an opportunity for public school students to rise from the COVID-19 pandemic in a better position than when the crisis began. Plus, a new novel chronicles how a fascinating array of characters experienced the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Rebecca Sachs joins me to talk about City of a Thousand Gates. First, the news. And good afternoon. Welcome. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. Glad you're with us on this warm Friday. Many kids in Maryland and around the country are back in classrooms as educators and parents grapple with the stark reality that many students have experienced learning loss in this pandemic year. On the other hand, some kids are thriving in virtual school. Part of the funding for education in the American Rescue Plan is directed toward attenuating gaps in academic achievement and in resources, as well as improving school infrastructure in underserved communities. My first guest today is Dr. Kalila Harris, who heads K-12 education policy at the Center for American Progress. She's also a senior fellow at the Maryland Center for Economic Policy. She served as the first deputy director of the White House Initiative on Educational Excellence for African Americans during the Obama administration. Kalila Harris joins us on Zoom. Hey, Kalila, welcome back. Always fun to talk to you.
Thanks so much, Tom. Always a pleasure to be here.
So you wrote a piece in the Hill, an op-ed a couple of weeks ago, which called for a kind of a reframing of the school debate. What do you mean by that? What are we getting wrong? What questions aren't we asking that we should be, and what questions are we asking that maybe aren't as important as they may seem?
Absolutely. So the first thing I do is hedge your commentary about learning loss. You know, our kids haven't, through the coronavirus, stopped knowing how to read, stopped knowing how to do mathematics. Unfortunately, when we use terms like loss, some people take that and decide it's time to fix children as opposed to fix systems. The students certainly have had interrupted learning, and we want to make sure we can bridge the gap to continue their learning. And that's really where the conversation needs to be and should have been since last March. What we want to see is children are having an opportunity to learn in environments that are safe in accordance with the CDC guidance. Unfortunately, people conflate ideas like we can go from 6 feet to 3 feet social distancing and leave out the part where that can happen in the case that all students are masked, that there's proper ventilation, that windows can open and close, there's proper heating and cooling, and so on, which we know is not the case in most Baltimore City schools. So, you know, since last year, we haven't had a focus on continuing learning, which would allow for partnerships with our park and rec centers, houses of worship, institutions of higher education, to bring students who really did need to be together into places that allowed for proper social distancing to protect the health and safety of both students and educators. So that's the shift that we want to make. And we aren't talking about the fact that 54% of public school buildings across the U.S. have been determined to be in disrepair or in need of complete replacement. And so those are the buildings we're pushing for lots of students to go back to under the false pretense of parents need to go to work. Well, you know, schools are not childcare centers. They are there for the benefit of the children, and they do support the economy to move. But if it is critical for us to get people back to work, then we should be innovative in the ideas we have on how we continue learning and not just live in this false binary of open the school buildings we have or keep them closed.
Well, there's a whole bunch to unpack there, and that's really fascinating. I want to start with this notion of so-called learning loss. There are a lot of folks. I was just talking to somebody with the school system this morning, and they are very convinced that kids simply are not reading at the levels that they should be or that they used to be, or, you know, computing math problems at the level that they should be or used to be able to compute. They're convinced that the learning loss is real, and they define it as learning loss. But it seems that you think maybe it's not nearly as acute a problem as they do. Is that right?
The problem that's acute is loss of opportunity and a gap in opportunity. I am resistant to the idea that some children would not be able to read or compute in the way that they were before, layering a deficit approach over them as opposed to an asset approach. That would presume that the children have been in a coma for the last year, and that they are not learning from the world around them, that their families are not reading to them, that they're not going on vacation and seeing the ocean, even if it's just, you know, out to Bethany Beach for a day trip so they can get back home and remain socially distant. Those are really difficult assumptions to be making about children and their families' ability to help them continue to take in the world around them and make sense of it. And that same ideal is what is a gap between how some children are engaged in education, but other children are engaged in a long series of test prep to meet a certain set of standards that don't really connect to their real world lives. And that is what I am resisting. So if we want to continue learning, let's think about ways to do that in the safest way, but let's not start bringing jargon in like learning loss as if it is not the case that children are human beings and human vessels that take in information and make sense of it every day using things that they've already learned. Because if that's the case, if they have not mastered certain things previously, that is not a child problem. That is a system problem.
Kalila Harris heads K-12 education policy at the Center for American Progress. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. To join our conversation with Dr. Harris, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. Our Twitter handle is @MiddayWYPR. And Kalila, when you talk and write about gaps in achievement, you also talk about gaps in resources. You mentioned these, you know, more than half of the schools in the United States, not only underserved, you know, so-called in underserved communities, but also just simply they weren't up to snuff before COVID, and they're probably not going to be up to snuff after COVID unless we focus in the right way. So with the money, $126 billion in the $1.9 trillion American Rescue Plan that President Biden has now passed through Congress, what do you think the focuses should be? What is the best way of approaching spending that money to improve infrastructure and lower, you know, attenuate the gap in learning and resources?
Mm-hmm. So last week, the U.S. Department of Education hosted a reopening summit, and the week before closed out a call for feedback from communities, advocates, policymakers on what reopening should look like and what kind of guidance they give to school districts. First and foremost, one innovation that I've seen coming up that I love is giving families the resources to attend summer programming and enrichment programming during the school year that they would not have been able to afford before. When you think about CTY at Johns Hopkins, which charges, when you think about sleepaway camp, which can be upwards of $1,000, $2,000 a week, these are opportunities that students in our communities have not been afforded that really helps to create a bigger gulf between them and more affluent families. So I love the idea of that. And I love the ways that it resists the concept of, you know, we're just going to give students a longer school year and a longer school day. Well, why should students with fewer resources be penalized and not be able to have things like sports after school, music lessons after school, enriching summer camp? Again, No one thinks that when students stop high school at 18 or what have you, that they no longer will be able to read, write, and do mathematics. So the idea that, you know, our students in schools all of a sudden need to double down on math and literacy is a throwback to an era where we had students losing recess and losing arts and humanities coursework so that they could pass a test so the district could prove that they were doing right by the children, even though the test doesn't actually tell us what context students are learning in, the quality of their teachers, the available resources in their school buildings. So that's one thing that I've been hearing. Another is providing, as I said, if we're going to use the community as a true classroom, providing tutors and aides who can come in and take students in small groups to outdoor learning. Thankfully, we're moving into spring and summer. Outdoor learning with smaller groups, especially so the babies can see each other and have some play but remain socially distant. Also, the idea of bringing in a large cohort of counselors who can both find children we haven't heard from since last March, and particularly our older students who are a lot more autonomous. It would be great if we had mental health professionals who can just go out, check on them, see what's going on, invite them back to school, figure out what their plans are for the future. And for those who are supposed to be accessing college, career, or trade, making sure they have more bodies who can support that in light of the gap in access that they've had to school. So there are lots of things that can be done. And that money is actually stipulated that at least 20% of it must be used to bridge that gap in learning, to bridge that interruption of time.
And one of the other things that you've written about is incentivizing strategies to bridge the digital divide. This, of course, became glaringly apparent that there was a huge digital divide once things started going all virtual, you know, about a year ago now. And what are some of the strategies that can be incentivized to reduce that digital divide and improve the infrastructure in that regard?
Great question, Tom. So we've seen some communities doing things like creating mobile hotspots and sending them out into communities that, you know, in the midst of counties and cities instituting public broadband as a utility, there still needs to be some mitigation in between for families that simply live in dead spots or, you know, more rural parts of their communities or states. So mobile hotspots I've seen popping up in some states would be a great idea to expand broadband access. And that broadband access, I have to say, we saw in Baltimore that there was a day where I think it was Zoom or Google Classroom shut down completely. Our school buildings also don't have the wiring necessary to have every single child using technology. So that needs to be worked on in the meantime. But those mobile hotspots, setting up community centers is another one that we've seen, putting full Wi-Fi throughout community centers that can be used within a 1 mile radius, not a 1 mile radius, a 500 foot radius, as well as in the building. Another innovative idea and strategy, and also our houses of worship. Getting those set up as community centers. And we know we have lots of churches in Baltimore, synagogues and mosques. Another innovation that can only help children to be in safe spaces as opposed to just pulling up next to a library to try to tap into the Wi-Fi.
Yeah, of course, Wi-Fi and broadband access, you know, perhaps really should be available for free for anybody in the city. We should simply have it, you know, because it's not just children who, you know, face a deficit if they don't have access to the internet. Let's go to the phones, to Owings Mills. Sharon is on the line. Sharon, welcome to Midday with Dr. Kalila Harris.
Good afternoon. I'm calling to make a comment about rethinking education, because I've been a very big proponent here in Baltimore County for virtual learning, looking at the positive pieces that we're seeing. A lot more minority parents are staying home and keeping their kids home because they're doing better. They're able to focus better. They're not having the kinds of distractions that they're having in the school buildings. It's not as overcrowded or as loud or as many students because they're home and they're able to concentrate and focus better, and suddenly they're learning. I've seen this in the special ed kids that I work with. As an advocate, some of my students, my clients, have been learning better than they've ever learned before.
Yeah, thanks for that comment. And clearly you've written about this as well. I mean, after COVID is over, after it's no longer literally dangerous, you know, or potentially dangerous to come to school, what do you think the role of virtual learning will evolve into at that point?
Absolutely. You talked about the $126 billion. One thing that certainly institutions of higher education and local education and state education agencies need to think about is professional development for teachers in training and teachers who are already in the field, school leaders who are already in the field, to understand how to do quality virtual learning, because we absolutely see there are students who are now thriving in this environment. And it's for a myriad of reasons, whether it be their learning styles, or as a teacher just said, having more focused attention when they have a learning difference that they need support with. But also some students just feel safer at home for whatever reason. And parents should be able to offer that space for them to continue learning, have the opportunity to be connected to a brick and mortar space, right? So I am not talking about 100% virtual learning. They're not in any school in particular. They're taking modules that are not synchronous and that kind of thing. I think that would be a detriment to any child. But the idea that students may have teachers in a schoolhouse who are from 1 to 2 p.m. doing Algebra 1 and they engage there, or from noon to 1 they are doing history, U.S. history or European history, whatever the case may be. That needs to remain, and we need to be innovative in how we think about the design of school and education. And another thing I push people around is the concept of education as opposed to just school. I think a lot of people are wedded to the brick and mortar model as opposed to what quality education means for children. And that means that every child has an individual education plan. And unfortunately, we warehouse children and expect them to follow the same regimen and conform to the same regimen. And that can be a detriment to students who have different learning styles, or frankly, just different cultures around what's acceptable when they're in a learning space.
Let's go to the phones. We're running out of time, but let's see if we can sneak Jackie in, who's calling from Columbia. Welcome to Midday with Kalila Harris.
Hi, Tom. I hope you can hear me.
Yep, we can.
Yeah, my question is, I'm an educator, former educator, and it seems like a lot of, they talk about data-driven, but when it comes to actually coming up with plans, there's no data to actually base the decisions on. Teachers are expected to do things that they're not equipped, have not been required to do, and they make these plans without teachers being at the forefront, making sure that they can do what they're being asked to do. And so, you know, all of these ideas, you put out all these wonderful ideas, but where's the data to show that parents are doing well at home?
Yeah, well, thank you for
okay,
that.
Yeah, what do you think, Kalila?
I was just going to say that the fact of the matter is, a reason why I have been shouting this from the mountaintops is the idea that children were going to keep doing what was happening in brick and mortar spaces virtually is the most nonsensical thing. It's like people ignored we were in the midst of a pandemic, ignored that close to 550,000 people lost their lives, wanted to get people back to normal so badly that they were trying to implement what was happening in a brick and mortar space online, which was completely inappropriate. And so now when we talk about assessments and trying to give children standardized tests to show what they learn and prove what they know, it takes no accountability around a pandemic. And that's true for our educators as well. No one took a pause and said, okay, you know, let's take July and August of 2020 to think about what things students need to master and leave the rest to the side, right? Do students need to know about the ride of Paul Revere in order to get them to a trade, the military, college, or being an entrepreneur? Absolutely not. So what are the things that we know are substantive for them to master, and then make sure our educators have training around that? Instead, it was take exactly what you do normally pre-COVID and do that online. And that was a travesty and remains a travesty because it was not fair to the educators and not fair to the children. And then the idea that we then assess what students are doing, I don't know what the data actually is going to tell us other than there was a pandemic. Because if it's going to tell us that students didn't get all the content, obviously we know that. But the idea that we have students who will not graduate because they don't have their credits that they would have earned is also unfair and ridiculous. And, you know, we need to be more innovative in how we think about that and how we think about obtaining data. What is the data we need to move forward? But how do we immerse ourselves in a reimagining of what education looks like and build that with support of the American Rescue Plan dollars?
Dr. Khalilah Harris is the Vice President for K-12 Education Policy at the Center for American Progress. And as always, Khalilah, we so much appreciate your ideas, many of which are provocative and, as we say in the biz, counter-narrative, which is terrific to hear. So I really appreciate your perspective. Thanks so much and look forward to the next time.
Always a pleasure.
Coming up now, coming up, a new powerful voice in American literary fiction. Rebecca Sachs has written a dazzling debut novel. She joins me to talk about it after a quick break. I'm Tom Hall. Stay with us.
You're tuned to Your Public Radio, 88.1 WYPR.